morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Sitting across from me, Mike Cosentino is off in Florida, swimming in the ocean or something. And Klaus von Stutterheim is here.
Okay,
Klaus, you want to say hello?
Hello, everybody. Good morning.
All right, and we have with us a guest today. We're going to be talking about renewable energy, solar, and we're talking about energy and what we can do to move to a less polluting world, because as things are heading, we're heading to a not-so-good climate catastrophe at some point. And so that's what we'd like to talk about. The big news today is, of course, that the Attorney General Barr said that that Trump campaign was at least his version of it is the Trump campaign didn't commit collusion with Russia, despite all these indictments of dozens of people for colluding with Russia. I think that that's kind of, if you went back to when before Trump was elected, that's our comments. I never thought it would as go as far as it did, the Russian thing. And we'll see what the actual report says. That'll make it interesting. So that's coming down. We'll do a show on that in a couple of weeks when this stuff settles out and we find out more what the report actually says. But today we want to talk about renewable energy, and we have with us John Haight. John, you want to introduce yourself to folks?
Well, yes. I'm a resident of the area and retired, but spending a career in business and in the investment banking world and in the software companies. I ran a couple of companies and developed them and sold them successfully. And so that's my hobby, in a way, is a lot of community action things. And one of the things that I become particularly concerned about is the question of the impacts on the climate and what it's going to do not only to where we live now, but also in terms of the greater country and world.
So you're not a scientist. You're speaking as a lay person, as someone who's trained in economics about the possibilities of solar and renewable energy, wind in this industry. So you're someone who's a concerned citizen, who's really been reading about this and trying to understand it. And you have a kind of background in economics that Klaus may have, but I don't. And so I, as we've talked a little bit before the show, I said to John, people still believe that, you know, solar, wind industry, energy is more expensive than coal. The coal is the, you know, dig it out of the ground, burn it. It's more efficient than any of our renewable energy. What's the story on this, John? I hear it's changing fairly radically.
Well, it actually is changed dramatically over a period of time. And the first thing that is creating that cause is the impact of the technologists developing much lower cost components that build a system for both solar and wind. And this has been taking place for a long time, actually, in countries outside the U.S., specifically China. One of the biggest wind producers in terms of products is actually Denmark, a company called Vesta. And they are building up the kind of technology that allows them to generate a lot more efficient energy. Time to market is much faster than trying to build a nuclear power plant, which sometimes takes 10 years or more, or doesn't even get completed. And coal-fired power plants are clearly not being built right now. They're being retired at an expanded pace, in fact, right now.
Is that because of environmental regulations, or why are they being first, folks, remember that all the stuff that we build has a certain time limited, whether it's a hydroelectric dam, whether it's a coal-burning plant. These structures and these industries have a time limited. They age out, And so a lot of our hydropower is aging out. And I think in Germany, particularly I think in France, a lot of their nuclear energy plants are aging out. They're just right on the edge of being retired. And so the French have a difficult situation because they don't have a lot of coal and gas.
That's correct. In fact, just for those that might be interested, there's an article in The Guardian today that came out talking about the economics, The Guardian being an English magazine and newspaper. And they actually, and I can quote from this one thing that is very significant in terms of their opinion as of March 25th. And they say around three quarters of U.S. coal production is now more expensive than solar and wind in providing electricity to American households. And they are predicting that there's going to be a significant reduction in coal production going forward. And so some of it is environmental. You're right, Steve.
But part of it is just economic. I mean, if three-quarters of it is more expensive than renewable, why would you build a polluting industry when you can build a non-polluting industry and deliver the same amount of power for less money?
I was under the impression that the coal plants at this point are replaced largely by natural gas plants. Isn't that right?
That is and that isn't true. They are in the interim, and most of them, from what I've read, understand the fact that natural gas is lower in pollution, lower in costs, and easier to put into production because of the turbine gas generators. And they are lower in pollution. And so they are kind of the bridge technology that a lot of people think is going to continue to move forward, as the other components, develop more and become more sophisticated.
So are they decommissioning coal plants then and building new gas-based plants, or are they trying to convert the plants?
No, the conversion costs on most of the plants are just enormous. I don't know if you ever had an opportunity to tour a big power plant, but they're very specifically designed specifically for one purpose. And the reconstruction of 40 or 50-year-old buildings is economically unaffordable, particularly when many of the coal company, the electric power producers that burn coal are owned by investors. And investors right now are looking for returns on the short term. And some of those models are not necessarily consistent with the longer term objectives of what we may need to move this more aggressively forward.
But in the early years of solar and wind power was more expensive than coal power.
Oh, yes. That was
in the early years when it was getting going. But there's now, what are the changes, John? Some are technological, some are maybe scale. Why is solar and wind and maybe other tidal energy, why are those, the prices of those going down while the others are remaining high or even getting higher?
Well, in the case of solar, for example, you have the opportunity to be able to now create what some of the utilities, including Arizona Public Service, is doing here. And there's been quite a bit of controversy about their positions and roles in that regard, but they are creating what they call wind or solar farms. In the case of Arizona Public Service, it's more the idea of large collected solar farms, so to speak, that generate large amounts of production out of one site. Roof solars are the least efficient. Regionally based or neighborhoods or whatever are sort of an interim. And then as you go larger, the scale is more important. The other thing is the costs are coming down, and what the utilities are also doing, particularly those that are in the transmission and distribution, they are starting to build out their infrastructure to be able to connect to these larger solar and wind farms. That was one of the problems that was encountered early on. There was no transmission lines for moving large capacities of power generated to where the market is.
So let me get this straight. You think that these large power fields, if folks have seen them, they're pretty impressive, acres of devices all same size pointing in the same direction. You think that's more efficient than rooftop solar? Because the big battle in Arizona politically is between APS and the rooftop solar people. And people like having rooftop solar. I mean, it's just something that people really like, generating their own energy. The problems have always been night, right, and storage of the industry. So everyone has to be patched into the grid anyway.
Well, and they're looking for the rebate that was coming from the electric power utilities to lower their energy costs to as close to zero as they could get it. And some people get it to zero or even get a credit. The problem with that is that it doesn't distribute to anybody else. If you have excess power, you either have to have those batteries or it essentially has to be sold some way into the grid. And the power companies are saying, we're not going to pay for that anymore because we have a more efficient way of producing than that.
They're not going to pay for it at all.
Well, that's what some of them are, but the position they're taking is exactly. You may invest in it, that's fine, and you may lower your bill, but you can't sell it back.
Right.
At one point, they had to buy it back, right?
Correct.
There wasn't that legislation that they had to buy it back in order to further solar power?
That's correct.
There was a big fight here over people were having solar and they were trying to sell it back, and APS was paying them much less for taking the solar energy into the system.
Correct.
Than it was in terms of charging them.
And there are some that are trying to move to not paying anything.
Right. And I know people who are close to not paying anything. And
yes.
It's because they installed solar a long time ago.
Yes.
And they got this deal. Do you think, John, and maybe Klaus too, do you think that solar is going to be less attractive as a rooftop thing in the future, or is it still going to remain attractive to an awful lot of people, particularly in a place like Arizona where God knows we have solar energy?
Well, we clearly do. Second sunniest state in the country. So
what's the first sunniest?
Pardon?
What's the first sunniest?
My understanding, it's Nevada. Ah.
Really?
But I'm not sure about that number, but that we're one or two, and maybe it depends on the measurement systems.
So there's a couple of statistics that they always say, which we have less solar energy than Germany, which is famously cloudy, at least in Arizona mine, and also of New Jersey. The percentage of renewable energy in New Jersey is much higher than Arizona with all our sunshine.
And even in Iowa, which has embraced wind and solar somewhat more than we would have expected. But there's one other interesting piece that really affects the economics of this, and that is the fact, take a look at Pacific Gas and Electric during the last summer, where their network, because of the, in many cases, the accused lack of maintenance on the systems, they are facing billions of dollars of lawsuits now for the fires that were created in Northern California. The net effect of that is PG&E is now filing for bankruptcy for the second time in less than 20 years.
Wow.
And the economic costs are so huge that who's going to pay for that net result of that damage in bankruptcy? You know who's going to lose. Klaus knows it. It's going to be the creditors. It's going to be the long-term and short-term debt holders, and it's going to be the shareholders.
Well, the shareholders first, of course.
Sure.
What's the accusation? What is it that they did or didn't do that may have caused the fires? Is it the transmission lines?
Well, it's not necessarily just the transmission lines. It may be the overhead line running from a distribution point into a home surrounded by forests, and a tree falls on the wire, and the wire is hot, and it starts the floor of the
collapsing
forest.
System spread
collapsing
the fire,
systems.
John. Worst fire, I guess, in California history. It's hard to think of that beautiful
area. Statistic
here,
I've got this about, you talk about the economics of this. They talk about there were 1,600 fires last year, burning more than 2 million acres. In the United States, the Department of Interior's estimated there were 71,499 wildfires responsible for burning 10 million acres of land and putting 4.5 million homes at risk, 2 million in California alone.
Yeah, one of my gripes, I guess you'd call it, for the last 7-8 years we've been on the air is that the United States has never invested enough money in firefighting in the U.S. and in fire prevention. They simply don't spend enough money to get the job done. They don't have you see these sort of crude helicopter things where they're dropping water. You see small tankers. You never see the possibility if the United States really put energy into figuring out how to do this, how to stop forest fires before they destroy as much.
Well, the problem with the forest fires, actually, I think, is a different one. The problem with the forest fires is that for about 100 years, the Forest Service didn't, put out every fire. And a lot of debris accumulated on the bottom of the forest, which became tinder. Forest fires were a natural thing. They burned, usually in sort of checkered patterns. And, Bambi lived in one of those clearings.
Which one, Claw?
You have to see the movie, I guess. But there wasn't that debris that, that served as tinder. And now when a fire blows up, it almost sterilizes the earth. It takes much longer to come back than before. And the Forest Service has now changed tune and, they're not fighting a lot of fires.
There's a whole lot of fire prevention. There's fires that are being started and stuff. The one in California is a example of the colossal size of it. To me, this has to be prevented. These huge mega fires. Even if we've made mistakes in the past, you can do prescribed burns and stuff even after a fire has been put out around the perimeter. And it's just not enough investment. Sometimes you have a job that needs to be done, and you just don't put enough resources in to actually manage it well. And I still think that that's the problem here. But
the problem, of course, with the Forest Service is that their allocation, their money gets cut every year. They just don't have enough money to fight the kind of the fires that they would like to fight. So they have no choice but letting them burn. And Montana, that's a big story.
Yeah.
August is wildfire season, and it's just a question of how bad is it going to get, not are there going to be any fires.
And every year they pull all the rangers and stuff from all the things that they're involved in, from fire, police enforcement to taking people around and turn them into firefighters for the fire season. I still think that needs to be, but I think we're getting a little off there. But,
right.
So, John, the price of solar and wind are going down. And explain to folks a little why that is, because I think people still remember back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when it was more expensive. It was something you did to prevent pollution, and because it was cool to control your own power and generate your own power for your house. I mean, people just really like the idea. What's caused the drop in prices?
Well, there's one of the biggest, of course, is the cost of the product itself. The solar panels are, I don't know what scale of difference from the early on. They're highly more efficient, as you see in the world I spent a lot of time in the Silicon Valley technology world, is things get smaller, they get faster, they get more powerful.
Moore's Law.
That's right, yes. And that's exactly what's taking place in that regard. When I don't have exactly the statistics on the size of, for example, a wind turbine, but for example, the wind turbines right now are in an order of magnitude of 4 to 5 times bigger in terms of the efficiency of the blades, the design, computer designs of them, the generators inside of the hub sitting up there, and the costs of procuring all of this equipment is lowering. And many cases, you can actually put wind farms, for example, on land that can still be productive in rural areas for agriculture.
And there are huge wind farms off in the ocean or right on the edge of the ocean in Europe now, and I don't know about the United States. There's certainly plans to build them. Everywhere you go, and you don't have to be in the wealthiest countries in the world to see wind production.
That's right.
You're backpacking, hiking in Spain, you're going to walk through a whole wind farm or when you cross over a ridge line.
Yes.
Because Spain has gone through all of their natural fuels a long time ago. So, in, I guess this is too difficult. I mean, it's too technical, but how much less polluting is something like solar or wind power compared to coal? And how much money do we spend cleaning up the coal that we burn in our plants? I don't want an exact figure, but it's fairly significant, right, John?
It's a huge figure, and the problem is that because of policies, I'm not suggesting how long they've lasted because I'm not sure, but you look at policies like, for example, West Virginia, 2 or 3 years ago, this huge a dam broke that's storing all kinds of polluted materials and those kinds of things coming out of the coal plants. And these are the kinds of unanticipated costs that you mentioned earlier, Steve, about things start to get old. Well, sludge ponds that have been there for 40 or 50 years, something starts to happen. And when they do happen, in a case not in the coal industry, but in the iron ore industry in Brazil, it killed thousands of people and destroyed a whole section of an area.
This is called, in some ways, externalization of cost. So if I have a coal-burning power plant and I pump a lot of pollution into the atmosphere and I pump a lot of pollution into the rivers, but you public, Mr. Public and Mrs. Public and Ms. Public, and you have to pick up the bill because it's an environmental issue. So I don't include the cost of cleaning up and the cost of building my coal plant and burning coal. You get to
correct
the bill, folks, which is the bill for the pollution. And all industries try to externalize as much of their costs as they can. In this case, it just gets externalized on us.
Well, that's exactly right. That's the model of extractive industries. They basically leave certain amount of things behind, whether it's an oil derrick that sits abandoned unless there's laws that force them to really do the deconstruction properly. There's slag piles from old refineries and ore processing facilities. It's something that is not factored into the costs, and so the politicians, whoever they are, they push the fact that, well, look at these economics, but they don't factor in the total costs. And that's the results of unintended consequences, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, Butte was practically poisoned by the copper industry.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, Butte, Montana with the...
Right.
It's a scary looking place.
It is.
My wife's father's from Butte, Montana.
Oh,
yeah. Butte, Montana was once times the largest percentage of Irish immigrants in the United States. Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It's sort of famous. When we were in Ireland, people had actually had relatives that ended up in Butte, too. So, but it is a scary-looking place, and their house was right on what is now one of these giant, scary, you've seen them, Klaus, these scary ponds, these huge holes in the ground, and you have a little house fairly nearby anyway, a block away.
Let me ask John a question that I've been curious about. What's the cost of wind relative to solar energy? Do you know that?
Sorry, I forgot to put it on mute.
Yeah, there's silicon for you right there.
Yeah, the sleepy guys.
So Klaus, is the cost of solar and wind, and maybe there's other energies, what's the comparison there? And then is solar cheaper than
well,
wind?
It depends on the state of where they are, I mean, and how they factor in the costs. If you have costs that are really sort of balanced out from what I've understood, and again, this is from the reading that I've done, is the costs are coming closer to being similar, but there are environmental constraints that may affect the relative costs one way versus the other. In other words, that North Sea area, northern Germany and Denmark and down along that coast, for example, they have highly favorable winds. So they have a high percentage of time for an extended part of the day where wind produces. Solar in states, for example, or countries that have longer winters, they're inherently not as efficient as those that may be sitting closer to the equator or someplace like here. We have longer sun periods. So those kind of costs balance out some of the differences. The other costs are how far away from a transmission or a distribution point are these necessary. In a huge country like the U.S., the mileage is a significant factor in the cost of delivery, versus if you're sitting in Germany where they have 80 million people in the size of the state of Montana.
Germany is a little smaller than Montana.
Right.
But it's about the same size.
But I think even the Germans are having some difficulties in taking the power from the North Sea and distributing it completely across Germany down into southern, what we call southern Germany, what we call Bavaria.
Yeah, Bavaria is where
I think there's some controversy there of getting the power efficiently around. I mean, you know, we don't start folks usually in life or in anything else with all the answers right away.
Right.
I mean, all this stuff, solar power, wind power, and once coal were all works that were in progress. You know, locomotives were a work in progress. The first of them were, I don't know what you'd say. You look at early locomotives, you wonder that they'll ever be of any use and doing anything anywhere. But
yeah, scientists were saying that the human body couldn't travel faster than 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting model, but I mean, Germany, for example, I looked at that a little bit more clearly because they have been a leader, and a lot of it you have to factor in is what is the government's policy also. Now, the government in Germany made a decision a few years back now to decommission many of their nuclear plants. Some of them were getting aged, but also they got kind of scared because of Fukushima.
Mm.
That is short-term putting pressure on the generation side to get capacities to meet the demands since German economy is doing quite well.
So let's talk about that. Something I hadn't mentioned with nuclear power. How does nuclear power factor in terms of economics, in terms of going through the whole process? Because you have to store the spent nuclear fuel eventually, right, which is another expensive and horribly politically fraught process. Nobody wants a bunch of nuclear waste buried nearby.
Well, and the interesting thing is in the case of waste, coming from Minnesota, that's XL Power up there, and they have several nuclear plants, but also they have been very aggressive in terms of trying to expand their energy portfolio in the solar and particularly the wind. But what they have found is that they have to store those rods on site. Currently, in the U.S., there's no public policy yet for having a central storage area. The closest they ever got was the Yucca Mountain project in Nevada, which largely was killed politically, even though they had spent hundreds of millions.
I remember that.
Yes, yeah. And that was going to be a central repository managed properly. Because right now, you've got where nuclear plants are, like the Palo Verde or whatever.
Palo
Verde here and others. They have the rods stored on site, and that was one of the biggest problems at Fukushima is that when the tidewaters and the tsunami pushed water into the rod storage areas, they couldn't keep the rods cool because they lost power. You have nuclear risks all over the country where you have nuclear power plants because of this decentralized storage issue that has not been addressed by most governments.
So wind and solar are just inherently less dangerous.
Yes, they are.
So nuclear power is extremely efficient, but you have to build so much redundancy into the containers for it. When you don't have a container for your nuclear plant, you end up with Chernobyl, right? Or they didn't bother to build a big containment thing.
Or they didn't even know all the pieces. But if you want to look at a place where it's going the wrong way, look at, I think it's called Hinkley Point in the UK. It's a plant that was being built by, Toshiba's, energy division or whatever it is. Maybe the old Westinghouse is involved too, but it's cost overruns. It's still not there. It just keeps going up in cost. The time length are running longer. And in fact, Toshiba went into bankruptcy because of it. And, you know, that part of the company. So it takes so long to get them into play. It can be 10, 15 years before you have a plan in production. And with the demand of an economy that's growing, you need to be able to respond in a more timely fashion to getting the energy load up.
But other than the storage of the waste material, which is obviously significant, there's not much pollution coming out of nuclear plants.
Correct. There's very little.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, they're attractive. I mean, there's one political debate was that that we had a recent initiative, I think, here in Arizona, and it didn't include nuclear in the calculations. They were talking about solar and wind, and they weren't calculating. And the conservatives came back and said, "Well, you know, nuclear power doesn't pollute. Why isn't it included in factoring how much of whatever you have to do?" Well, the reason is that nuclear plants have just gotten more and more and more and more expensive.
Oh, almost it's almost undetermined as to what the final costs will be on these plants. And it's partially due to regulation, but there is an output of nuclear plants that is.
Well, I do want regulated nuclear plants.
Yes,
sure.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, we all do.
I do want government supervision. I do want them regulated.
We're Democrats.
For yes. Yes. Because non-regulation would not be good.
Right. But nuclear power plants have a big impact on water. They are huge consumers, as are coal plants, of water to cool. And the net effect of that is that in rivers that you're trying to keep more natural, not natural, but livable, you're running into these kinds of problems. Is the water is getting hotter, it's affecting lots of things. And if you look at what's happening in the Midwest right now with the flooding, well, some of those plants are being threatened. In Nebraska, for example, there's two big nuclear power plants that they've got some concerns about.
Yeah, the flooding, if you see it in person, the flooding in the Midwest, when it floods, when those rivers flood, it's amazing. It's miles and miles of flooded land and fields and farms, and it's pretty amazing to see, and that's what's going on particularly in Nebraska now. So you would advocate what percentage of our power should eventually be renewables, all of it?
Well, I don't think all of it is ever going to get there. I think that the role that coal will play in it, that particular production is going to go way down. I think that natural gas will still be a presence there because they will make turbines more effective. And in the case of a place like Texas or something that has natural gas very close to the generating sites, the cost model is pretty low. But I think that we can start to move to others. Tidal-based initiatives are in the future.
What are tidal-based? What do you mean?
This is a technology that they're looking at where they actually use the tidal currents along the coasts of countries, and that movement generates electricity.
And that's still pretty experimental?
Yes, it is, from what I understand. And there are some outstanding institutions in the West Coast, in California in particular, that are working on some of that. But you know, the thing, if I may make one comment about this in the model that I think is flawed, is that there's a very short-sighted view on the part of many governments, and ours in particular, about looking a little longer term on this whole process, because you don't get elected if you have a long term approach and you don't talk about anything short term. And here's just one case I'd like to make, and this is an article that was a huge article about, and it's called The Crude Awakening. It's in The Economist in late February.
Left wing rag.
Yeah. And basically they talk about the fact that
according to ExxonMobil, oil and gas demand will rise by 13% by 2030. So they're still betting the farm a lot on this. Mr. Woods, the CEO, is betting a lot of the farm on the fact that he is going to continue to pour money into this side of it, because his return is measured on such a short-term basis that not only does he want, and it even says that in the article, he wants to keep his job, he wants to keep the dividends flowing to the shareholders and the prices up. So he's not in line with what may be in the best interests of the country on a longer term basis.
And that's the problem with the American industry and stuff, is that if you worked in it, there's always a new guy coming in and changing everything, and then as soon as he gets a little boost in the stockholder value, he moves on to another multi-million dollar job somewhere else, and then you get the next short-term fixed guy who's going to push the profits up a little bit. He pushes the profits up. It doesn't matter how. And then he moves on. He's rewarded for his effort.
Well, usually the way it's done is that they fire half the employees,
yes,
raise the price, and then eventually go bankrupt so they don't have to pay the pensions.
Well, there's also,
I mean, that's the model of private equity.
There's also,
right,
the model from the peasant's point of view of all these reforms that, you know, you get one boss after another who changes everything, and then the next boss has to prove he could do it too, and he changes everything. And as a poor schlunk, working in this, I guess it's white collar part of this stuff, but sometimes not, you have to adjust to all these variation. So what's happening is the cost of sustainable production is going down. The cost of non-sustainable production is going up. But there's also, John and Klaus, there's also the politics of this. People are not, in Germany, frankly, they looked at it and said, here's a long-term problem we have. You know, our coal is a kind of coal that's very polluting, et cetera, et cetera. Let's invest in wind industry and stuff. But there's very little of that, unless it's forced somehow, John, by economic forces, for people to think long-term. Think, like, what's the effect of this plant going to be on a generation from now? Or how are we going to clean up the pollution from this? Or what is it going to cost us? There's just not much long-term thinking. We tend to be really looking for a quick fix. Like, how can we get the power plant up and running, you know, whatever.
Well, I mean, there's a political and sort of financial cycle which emphasizes what you're saying, short-term views. People want to get reelected, and the stockholders want to see either rising price or a dividend. At the end, though, economic forces prevail no matter how hard you strain against them and try to slow them down. So, it's inevitable. It's just a question of how long, are politicians and companies like Mobil going to be able to stem the tide. But it's inevitable. It's coming, and there's nothing's going to change that.
Yeah, the problem, the wild card in this whole process, in my opinion, is the fact that many of the factors that are moving slowly to reduce the impacts on the climate and the environment, in terms of what is going on a short-term basis, I'm no expert on this, except the fact that there's, you know, five of the hottest years we've ever had have been five of the last 10 years, and during this period of time, we're facing the fact that there are big issues. And somebody says, well, it was really cold and terrible in Minnesota this past winter, and it was. But those are the kind of variations we've had before. But the net overall effect of what's happening in, and what impact does that have to us living even right here in Sedona or in Arizona? It's huge. We have limited supplies of water. We have a lot of fire risk. We're facing some issues that we're ignoring.
A lot of people just don't care, though, John.
They don't.
Say, well, you know, that's down. There's a, in compassion studies, the psychologist, there's a certain word for people who care about the next generation or so, intergenerational, compassional, something like this technical term or that they've made up. But what it means is there are some people who care about grandkids and great-grandkids and the United States in 100 years and the world in 1,000 years, whatever. And there are other people that just don't. They've got so many immediate problems. They just don't, they just don't get involved in these things. And so the coal plants and stuff are helping to produce climate change, right?
There's no question. They're one of the major contributors, not alone. Cement plants are another huge one, for example. But
Steve, I mean, and what you said, you know, people basically putting their head in the sand. I mean, it's further amplifies or legitimized by our government telling us that the whole thing is a hoax and that, you know, climate just varies. I mean, we know that's not true, but that's what they've been managing to convince a large part of the population. There is something else happening, and I think it's going to have my forecast is that it's going to have a very significant impact. And that's that suddenly with the new Green Deal, which has a lot of utopian stuff in it, but people are suddenly starting to talk about it. And especially the young people are starting to talk about it because they're going to have to live in this world. I mean, suddenly within the last few months, actually, climate has become a major conversation around the country. And I suspect that's going to be a force that's going to counteract the old monopolies of oil and gas and traditional utilities.
I think that there are so many forces that are going on, and so much of it is lack of political will and political understanding. Another thing that Klaus alluded to was, you know, I'm originally from Oklahoma. The oil and gas industry dominated the whole state. You could not be a senator from Oklahoma and be for renewable energy. And you still haven't gotten anybody, I think, who there was a small period where you had some elected representatives. The rest of them, you know, in some way, George Bush, W, was a creature of the coal and gas industry. They provided a lot of his money. The modern conservative movement is being heavily funded by extractive industries. Extractive industries could be coal, but it could also be mining iron. And these are heavily funding, Koch brothers are heavily funding the resistance to the idea of climate change. In the same way that the cigarette companies funded elaborate scientific semi-scams to convince people that smoking was good for you, even as well as not. So, John, we've got 2 minutes. Sum up our entire conversation in 1 minute.
Well,
1 minute and 30 seconds.
1 minute, 30 seconds. Well, I think what we tried to do today was to create some understanding about the fact that the economic model, in terms of being able to have alternatives versus what we traditionally have in electric power generation and other types of energy fields, are happening, and we can move forward. I have one idea in this whole thing that we just threw out in 15 seconds, and that is the fact that right now, one of the things that we do not do, and this is another topic in the school system, is we don't teach hardly anything about economics, and we don't teach anything about how basically some of the basic things of what keeps our society moving forward are all about.
Well, thanks for being with us, folks. This broadcast is available on our website at iTunes and stuff. This and all our broadcasts and I think next week we'll have been on the air for 8 years. We appreciate any contributions. The website has a little button you could press on and donate it for it. We've been able to stay on 8 years. Nobody believed we'd be able to make this work or stay on. I must say we were surrounded by all these progressive people were filled with unprogressive doubts and didn't think we should do this. But
what's the address of the website?
VVID.org or VerdeValleyIndependentDemocrats.com. So we want help us keep our independent democratic voice on air, folks. Contribute to democratic perspective. Thank you all for listening in. It's a beautiful day out there. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.